So you may say, aren't you talking about the British Empire? I answer, no, the so-called British Empire was a manifest of the world around misconception of who ran things and a disclosure of the popular ignorance of the great pirates' absolute world controlling through their local stooge sovereigns and their prime ministers as only innocuously and locally modified here and there by the separate sovereignties' internal democratic processes. As we shall soon see, the British Isles lying off the coast of Europe constituted, in effect, a fleet of unsinkable ships and naval bases commanding all the great harbors of Europe. Those islands were the possession of the topmost pirates. Since the top pirates were building, maintaining, supplying their ships on those islands, they also, logically, made up their crews out of the native islanders who were simply seized or commanded aboard by imperial edict. Seeing these British islanders aboard the top pirate ships, the people around the world mistakenly assumed that the world conquest by the great pirates was a conquest by the will, ambition, and organization of the British people. Thus was the great pirates' grand deception victorious, but the people of those islands never had the ambition to go out and conquer the world. As a people, they were manipulated by the top pirates, and they learned to cheer as they were told of their nation's world prowess. The topmost great pirates Leonardos discovered, both in their careful long-distance planning and their anticipatory inventing, that the grand strategies of sea power made it experimentally clear that with a plurality of ships could usually outnumber one ship. So the great pirates Leonardos invented navies. Then, of course, they had to control various resource-supplying mines, forests, and lands with which and upon which to build the ships and establish the industries essential to building, supplying, and maintaining their navy's ships. Then came the grand strategy which said, divide and conquer. You divide up the other man's ships, and in battle, you divide up the other man's ships in battle, or you best him when several of his ships are hauled out on the land for repairs. They also had a grand strategy of anticipatory divide and conquer. Anticipatory divide and conquer was much more effective than tardy divide and conquer, since it enabled those who employed it to surprise the other pirates under conditions favorable to the latter. So the great top pirates of the world, realizing that dull people were innocuous and that the only people who could contrive to displace the supreme pirates were the bright ones, set about to apply their grand strategy of anticipatory divide and conquer to solve that situation comprehensively. Grand pirates came into each of the various lands where he either acquired or sold goods profitably, and he picked the strongest man there to be his local headman. The pirate's picked man became the pirate's general manager of the local realm. If the great pirate's local strongman in a given land had not already done so, the great pirate told him to proclaim himself king. Despite the local headman's secret subservience to him, the great pirate allowed and counted upon his king stooge to convince his countrymen that he, the local king, was indeed the headman of all men, the God-ordained ruler. To guarantee that either stooge king's secret lines of supplies, which provided everything required to enforce the sovereign claim. The more massively bejeweled the king's crown, and the more visible his court and castle, the less visible was his pirate master. The great pirate said to all their lieutenants around the world, "Any time bright young men show up, I'd like to know about it, because we need bright men." So each time the pirate came into port, the local king ruler would mention that he had... some bright young men whose capabilities and thinking shone out in the community. The great pirate would say to the king, "All right, you summon them and you deal with them as follows. As each young man is brought forward, you say to him, 'Young man, you are very bright. I am going to assign you to a great history tutor, and in due course, if you study well and learn enough, I'm going to make you my royal historian. You've got to pass many examinations by both your teacher and myself.' And when the next bright boy was brought before him, the king was to say, 'I'm going to make you my royal treasurer,' and so forth. Then the pirate said to the king, And you will finally say to all of them, you will finally say this to all of them, but each of you must mind your own business or off go your heads. I am the only one who minds everybody's business. And this is the way the schools began, as the royal tutorial schools. You realize, I hope, that I am not being facetious. That is it. That is the beginning of the schools and colleges and the beginning of intellectual specialization. Of course, it took a great wealth to start the schools, to have great teachers, and to house, clothe, feed, and cultivate both the teachers and the students. Only the great pirate-protected robber barons and the pirate-protected and secret intelligence-exploited international religious organizations could afford such scholarship investments. And the development of the Bright Ones into specialists gave the king very great brain power and made him and his kingdom the most powerful in the land, and thus, secretly and greatly, advantaged his patron pirate in the world competition with the other great pirates. But specialization is, in fact, only a fancy form of slavery, wherein the expert is fooled into accepting his slavery by making him feel that in return he is in a socially and culturally preferred, ergo, highly secure, lifelong position. But only the king's son received the kingdom-wide scope of training. However, the big thinking in general of a spherical earth and celestial navigation was retained exclusively by the great pirates, in contradistinction to a four-cornered flat world concept with empire and kingdom circumscribed knowledge, constricted to only that which could be learned through localized preoccupations. Knowledge of the world and its resources was enjoyed exclusively by the great pirates, as also were the arts of navigation, shipbuilding and handling, and of the great logistical strategies and of nationally undetectable and therefore effectively deceptive international exchange media and trade balancing tricks by which the top pirate, as in the gambler's parlance, the house, always won. Chapter 3. Comprehensively Commanded Automation. Then there came a time, which was World War I, when the most powerful out pirates challenged the in pirates with the scientific and technological innovation of an entirely new geometry of thinking. The out-pirates' attack went under and above the surface and into the invisible realm of electronics and chemical warfaring. Caught off guard, the in-pirates, in order to save themselves, had to allow their scientists to go to work on their own inscrutable terms. Thus, in saving themselves, the great pirates allowed the scientists to plunge their grand industrial logistics support strategy into the vast range of the electromagnetic spectrum that were utterly invisible to the pirates. The pirates until then had ruled the world through their extraordinary keen senses. They judged things for themselves, and they didn't trust anyone else's eyes. They trusted only that which they could personally smell, hear, touch, or see. But the great pirates couldn't see what was going on in the vast range of the electromagnetic reality. Technology was going from wire to wireless, from track to trackless, from pipe to pipeless, and from visible structural muscle to invisible chemical elements, strengths of metallic alloys and electromagnetics. The great pirates came out of that First World War unable to cope knowledgeably with what was going on in the advanced scientific frontiers of industry. The pirates delegated inspection to their troubleshooter experts, but they had to content themselves with relying on second-hand information. This forced them to appraise blindly, ergo only opinionatedly, whether this or that man really knew what he was talking about, for the great pirates couldn't judge for themselves. Thus, the great pirates were no longer the masters. That was the end. The great pirates became extinct. But because the great pirates had always operated secretly, and because they hoped that they were not through, they, of course, did not announce or allow it to be announced that they were extinct. And because the public had never known of them and had been fooled into thinking of their king stooges and local politicians as being, in reality, the headman, society was and is, as yet, unaware either of that the great pirates once ran the world, or that they are now utterly extinct. Though the pirate sugar are extinct, all of our international trade balancing and money ratings, as well as all the economic accounting in both the capitalistic and communist countries, hold strictly to the rules, value systems, terminology, and concepts established by those great pirates. Powerful though many successors to the great pirates' fragmented dominion may be, no one government, religion, or enterprise now holds the world physical or metaphysical initiatives.